The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivalled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Laura Prendergast.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Tim Haywood, an award-winning food writer, broadcaster and proprietor of the bakery Fitzbillies in Cambridge. Tim writes regularly for the FT magazine and often appears on BBC Radio 4. Following the bestsellers Food DIY, Knife and Loaf Story, his eighth book, Steak, The Whole Story, is out at the end of May. Tim, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you very much indeed. Lovely to be here.
Tim, we always start at the beginning on Table Talk. What are your earliest memories of food?
Oh, gosh. I know precisely what it is, and it's absolutely terrifying. The first thing I actually remember sort of seeing being prepared and me consuming it was, we didn't have very much money when we were kids, and my mum used to do this thing where we'd have white bread, and you'd cut the slice into quarters, and then that would be deep fried, or fried in the pan that the bacon had been fried in that morning. And then she'd smear mashed potato on top of it, and you put your little infant thumb into the middle of it and made a hole into which you poured ketchup.
That sounds delicious.
I think it's pretty gorgeous, but I've got a cardiologist who would strongly disagree.
Fair enough.
I was going to say, do you still make it now?
I made it a while back, actually, just because I'd been writing about it, and it's one of those things whereby you really can't go back with food memories.
Did it have a name, this dish?
I think it was called Dead Man's Eyes or something. Or it may have had some deeply racially insensitive name at that point as well. I have literally no idea. Mum can't remember. Oh, we never ate anything like that, she would say. But no, we did. I promise we did.
And what were mealtimes like when you were growing up? Were they an important part of family life?
I think Mum used to cook a fair bit. I think, to be fair to her, she was of that. I don't think she was sort of Elizabeth David generation, but she was of a generation that was conscious of food. Mum would have made my first spaghetti bolognese, and I would have loved that. And she was quite keen on you know, there being decent, well made bread around most of the time. And she had a big downer on chips, which was a slightly unfortunate thing. Mum thought that chips would kill us all with the cholesterol, and my father was an insurance investigator, and pretty much every week he'd have to come home after digging out somebody's house with a chip pan fire in it. And then one day we had a very small chip pan fire, and Dad took the chip pan to the bin, and we never had chips again. And my nan, who'd actually grown up in a chip shop, I used to have to go round to her house and have chips, and she used to bribe me with chips, and it was just great. So I think that was the start of my whole dreadful relationship with food from that point onwards, was all about parents and grandparents and the forbidden chip.
And what about school food? Do you have happy memories of school food?
Oh, God. Well, I really like institutional food. I think it's lovely, and we underrate it at our peril. But I went to the grammar school in Bristol, which was very sweet at the time, but it had sort of pretensions of being a much more posh place than it was, I think. But I do remember the Macedoine of vegetables. And the Macedoine of vegetables was, you know, those sacks of mixed veg where you get peas and carrot cubes and swede and things like that all in there. And they take that and they defrost it in the white sauce and then heat it up. And I do remember Kevin Baragwanath, who was he was a gorgeous boy in the sixth form with lots of blonde hair. I remember him languidly saying, yes, they call it a Macedoine because it tastes like it's been eaten already by a Macedonian. And I thought it was the wittiest thing I'd ever heard. God knows what happened to him. He's probably a postman now or something. But yeah, that would have been the one. I do remember the Macedoine of veg with absolute terror.
And were you interested in cooking when you were growing up? Was that something that started early?
No. Weirdly, it all kicked off much later. I remember the other day when I cooked to impress my first girlfriend, and I was quite old at that time, so it definitely hadn't been during my childhood. Didn't cook much as a student, but I grew up on the South Coast, and the only jobs you could get were in hotels and restaurants, and I didn't want to be a waiter. I just didn't like people that much.
Am I right in thinking there was some tequila? There was some raw handing out tequila. That's in our notes here. Tell us about that.
God, that was So my first job after I graduated was in a restaurant. I was a bouncer in a Mexican restaurant. And one night the slammer girl didn't turn up. And these are the girls who wore a bandana full of glasses and two holsters, one full of champagne and lime mix and one full of tequila. And they pour out these slammers and you were supposed to show the customer how it was done. And you put the... You pour the two drinks in, you put a beer mat on top of it, slam the thing on the table, and while it's still fizzing, you throw it down your neck. And if we were asked to demo, which idiots would often say, oh, we'll buy a round if you'll drink one, you're supposed to drink only the mixer, not the tequila. So I got started, beginning part of the evening, and I just kept going, and about halfway through, I started drinking the tequila as well. And we got to the end of the evening, and there was one couple left in the restaurant. And I went over and tried to sell them two more glasses. And the guy said, look, we'll buy two more glasses if you go away and stop bleeding on the table. And at some point earlier in the evening, I'd done it without putting the beer mat on. I'd ground the glass into my hand. I had literally no idea that I'd done that. And just bled everywhere. I was fired the next day, but it was okay because actually the same day I was going to leave anyway. I was supposed to be flying to America after the waitress who became my first wife, and I was following her out there. So I was going anyway, but God, the hangover lasted 4 days, most of which I had to spend in various airports across the deep south of America, and it almost made me give up drinking, but almost not.
And tell us about your time in America then. What was the food like at that point?
Well, it was really strange. My first wife was from North Carolina, sort of rural south. And I didn't have a green card and we didn't want to get married initially. So I just worked illegally and we would work in small diners and sort of any kind of kitchen where I could be a line cook. And I'm not a chef, I'm not trained as a chef. I had worked in hotel kitchens and things like that down on the South Coast. So I knew my way around. And I was actually a very competent line cook. So you could put me on most of the stations and I could do it, but I could never do anything elegant or beautiful. And we used to drive around in our beaten up truck and we'd sort of pull into a small town somewhere and buy a couple of coffees at the diner. And by the time we came out, she'd be a waitress and I'd be a line cook. And we just moved around, staying in different places, living in different places, working in amazing joints. And I just loved the food. I loved the hospitality. I worked in places like in New Orleans and all over Mississippi and Alabama and Tennessee, in the weirdest of places. And people always think diners are, they think it's rollerblading waitresses and rock and roll on the jukebox. And it's not. They're independent restaurants, usually run by immigrant families. So there's an enormous number of them were run by Lebanese or Greek families in weird places out in the middle of Alabama. And everybody behind the line would be talking Greek except me. And we were turning out not burgers and chips like you'd imagine, but kind of down-home, ordinary food that real people wanted. And it was terribly, terribly democratic. I remember one place I worked, we used to start the shift at about 5 o'clock in the morning, and the farmers would park their tobacco combines that they would then drive out to harvest the tobacco in the fields. They'd park them outside the restaurant and they'd come in for their breakfast. And then the local volunteer fire brigade would come in for their breakfast. And then one of the school buses used to turn up and they used to pick up bag lunches to take out some of the poor kids out in the areas where they didn't get a decent meal. And then one day the mayor called up and said, I've forgotten it's my wife's anniversary, can you put something together? And we baked them a cake and we gave them a booth. And it was so, I don't know. And it really got me into the whole idea of that democracy around food and how much I really, really loved it. And that's when your sort of emotional desire to feed people and be hospitable really taps in. Mm-hmm. And after that point, I couldn't be stopped. You know, I would force dinner parties on people that would never ask me back simply because I said, oh, come up, you sit around the table and you eat loads of food and it's great, it's fun, it's lovely. Yeah, that really got the enthusiasm going.
And where did you go after that? What was the next step?
Oh, God, I came back here, got a job in TV and then went straight from there to advertising. The marriage didn't survive. I became a complete arsehole. And for about 20 years, I think, of being an appalling, appalling man. A shameful beast of a human being. But in all that degradation, they paid for me to eat out on their ticket pretty much every day of the week. And it was intriguing because actually so many of the restaurant critics now come from backgrounds of that generation of advertising or marketing. Mm. Because we were the only people who'd been to all the posh restaurants. I mean, I remember when the foodie handbook first came out, the first time the word foodie had ever been used. It was the year after the Sloan Ranger handbook, written by the same people. And it was right back there just before that sort of, I think it was 1998 it kicked off. But already by that point, I was this obnoxious little git being spending a lot of time in restaurants. So what I did eventually quit and sort of wanted to start writing. I'd always thought it would be a good idea to be a writer when I was at school because I thought they didn't do much work and it was kind of glamorous, how little I knew. But I didn't put pen to paper apart from to sign the occasional check until I was 40 because my daughter had been born, something of a surprise, and my wife at that point, we were both working at the same ad agency, but she was making a shed load more money than me. So she went back to work and I went to be a stay-at-home dad. And it was wonderful. And I typed my first pieces. Initially, I wanted to be a comedy writer. So I contributed really bad jokes to Radio 4 programmes that are 5 were a joke. But it didn't do for me what it did for Woody Allen, unfortunately. So I then thought I'd be a screenwriter. Because nobody wants to teach you to write in England. It's a funny thing. We don't have sort of creative writing courses or journalism courses in the same way as they do in the States. But screenwriters, they won't shut up about it. Everybody wants to do screenwriting courses. So I did 3 screenwriting courses back to back. Never wrote a full screenplay, but it kind of drummed out of me any remaining love for cinema. And after that, I just thought, I know about food. I'll start writing about food. And I pretty quickly got stuff in The Guardian. And after that, it just never went back.
And when you started writing about food, were you doing restaurant criticism at that point? Or was it sort of cookery food writing?
It was weird. I don't write recipes because I don't really cook with recipes. I'm pretty rubbish at them. So it's quite an effort for me to force myself to do them. And I never wanted to be a restaurant critic. Always thought it'd be a loathsome job. Partly because I own restaurants. I mean, what a terrible thing to do, to have to go in and be rude about people. So I never thought I would. So I was writing about the kind of science and history and lore of food. And the stuff around it, the social stuff around it. And it just became, because food writing became such a big deal so quickly around that time with this renewed interest in food, there was never a shortage of places to write for. Mm. And you can just, Christ, the history of the sandwich, 4,000 words, bang, woof, why not? And people wanted to read that, particularly if you did it in an entertaining way. Mm. And then when the reviewing gig came up, I was quite resistant. And then I thought, actually, okay, I'll give it a go. And I got into the mindset after a while. I sort of enjoy it. It's now quite distinct that I do the kind of writing that I enjoy writing in the books. And the reviewing is a very different kind of thing.
And how do you think food writing and restaurant criticism has changed since you've been doing it? I mean, we now live in an era of kind of almost like hyper reviews where everything is reviewed and not just by critics, but
I don't think we ever talk about anything else. It's an absolute obsession amongst the restaurant critics because they don't even call us restaurant critics anymore. We don't call ourselves that. It's usually restaurant writer or something along those lines. The big gun critic probably thankfully died with A.A. Gill. The idea of somebody who ponced around living the role of the bon viveur and condemning somebody to death with their pen. People didn't like that. There's still a feeling that perhaps we should be writing. I think some readers get a bit jumpy if we don't write a lot about the food and tell them whether it was good value for money and whether the toilets were clean and things like that. And it's got nothing to do with consumer writing. Mm. When Time Out went out of business, that was the last time anybody cared about reading a review that told you that someone was good value for money. It's not that. Mm. Since the lockdowns, we don't write bad reviews.
Do you think that's a shame?
It's difficult, isn't it? I mean, I hated the idea of writing bad reviews. They're enormous fun to write. Mm. Terrific fun to write, and people love them.
Yeah. If you don't like somewhere, do you just not review it then?
Well, what would you? So most of the job is the research. We spend all of our time looking for new restaurants. If I went to a restaurant and it wasn't good enough to write 1,000 words about, I wouldn't be doing my job. Literally no reason not to go to a decent restaurant every time. In fact, I should be going to a decent restaurant every time. I think quite a lot of us before the pandemic, I would do 4 a year, I reckon. I would line them up and I'd think, I haven't done an absolute killer for a while. And you'd usually pick somebody who wouldn't be too badly hurt. Gino De Campo was always a good one. You can find somebody like, if Gino De Campo's opening a new restaurant, let's go do that. You know, Jamie Oliver, let's kick the hell out of him. He doesn't care whether we live or die. Quite a few of the ones that sort of opened up in Mayfair which never even really bothered to court the reviewers because they didn't need it because nobody could afford to go anyway. Mm. Those places were absolutely ripe for a kicking. Mm. And some of the reviewers of some of those places, they'll go down in history as some of the most vitriolic ever. And they were great. But now nobody wants to hear that. I don't think we want to write that. I'm very conscious of being in a sector, in an industry that's absolutely on its arse end. Mm. We are in huge trouble, and it's not going to get any easier at all. I think if I have a thing at the moment, I think it's the old marketing man in me, the old ad man, says that from about 2000 onwards, we went from being a country where people went out to a restaurant about once a month if they were reasonably well off, to a country where now everybody of all classes feels it is right for them to either go out or eat out pretty much every day of the week, at least once. Mm. Or to sit at home while somebody cooks their food for them and brings it to them on a bike. Mm. And there's a generation that can't cook. And I don't know where we're going to go with this, because I know as a restaurateur, the salary increases have been absolutely vast. The food cost increases are huge. We're having to keep putting prices up and up and up and up. And we're going to have to put them up more. National minimum wage is going to go up again, I think, next month. And, you know, with everything, again, we're going to have to crank it up. People are not going to be able to afford to go out and eat all these times. Mm. But they don't know what else to do. So they're going to end up eating more crap from Deliveroo. And we've got to try and do something to get all of those people back to the simple bit of, I don't know, it's something, cooking for your family, surely it's supposed to. It's what we're supposed to do as animals, you know. We don't have to go out and kill the stuff anymore, but we've got to get it in and make it and give it to the children. It's what we do.
Mm. And you now live in Cambridge and you're the proprietor of Fitzbillies. I mean, what's that been like as an experience?
Oh, crazy. Absolutely crazy fun. I went to art college. I didn't even go to university. So going to a university town, particularly a university town like Cambridge, which is just bizarre, and meeting those people and being part of it. I think we're 104 years old now, which makes us the youngest institution in Cambridge. It's tremendous. But when we took the place over, it was bankrupt. We were still living in Camden Town, and I was going up every day to work with the builders. And people used to come in off the street, and they'd say, oh, we're really glad you're sort of saving the place. And when my wife had suggested we do it, I said, you're absolutely crazy. You've never worked in catering. You haven't got the faintest idea. This high street is going absolutely down the tubes. You are mad. We must not do this. And she said, we're going to go and see it tomorrow. So we went to see it the following day, and I never argued. But I always thought it was a crazy thing. But she's a brand expert. She said, no, you don't understand. It's a great brand. And while I was working in there, I think we were 3 months, we were in there stripping the place out. And people used to come in, and I always thought they were coming, because I was a Londoner, I always thought they were coming in to nick my tools. And they weren't. They were coming in to say, you know, my husband proposed to me here, and this is the last place we brought Grandad before he went into hospital, and then I came out, and, you know, I came here after I graduated, and I remember bringing my son here before he first came up to Oxford. We came in here before his interviews, and he was crying over there in the corner. And you realise that the really strange thing for me was it was the most poncy, upper-class English place I'd ever been, and I realised the place was a diner, just like the ones in Alabama. It was ridiculously democratic, because you've got, I don't know, I remember the first time Stephen Hawking wheeled in, and I thought, wow, you know, I think we're probably safe in saying we have had more Nobelist customers than any other eating facility in the world, because they've all come in at some point or another and had a bun. That's great. And we've got all that going on. But at the same time, you know, the builder's trucks pull up outside every morning on the double yellow lines, duck in and buy sausage rolls. Mm. And we're still making everything from base ingredients. And we don't even talk about it that much, to be honest, but it's just so strangely old-fashioned.
Have you kept, because obviously it's known for its buns, same
deal. Yeah, we no longer cook them at the back of the shop. We've got a facility out, which is much healthier, thank God, for the bakers to work in. But we still make it the same recipe, but everything's just from base ingredients. And it's so, nobody else does that. It's a funny thing because you're actually running, everybody thinks it's a cake shop and everybody sort of wears little frilly bonnets and does a little bit of icing and glues flowers to things. And it's a fancy cake operation. It's a Victorian factory. So there's a lot of lifting up of big trays and putting of buns into ovens, and here's another half ton of flour is to be brought in. And it's all manual physical work. And it's lovely. I love it. It's it grounds me in what I do.
There are obviously a ton of challenges with running any kind of restaurant or hospitality business, as we've talked about. But what have the highs been since you took on Fitzbillies?
Oh, gosh. It's just really sweet, tiny things. I think when we started, we were quite professional about it. And we tried... I remember saying to Al very many times, look, they're not your kids. The staff are not your kids. And about halfway through, we realised they actually are. Sod it, they are. And we're, you know, and it's I've got 85 children now of various sorts. And some of them are really nice. And some of them are utterly horrid, as all children are, you will discover. I mean, it's great. They're lovely. And they're lovely people. But the customers is brilliant. And I've seen... I remember a couple of weeks ago, I saw a couple come in. I've known them since the beginning. And they came in and they had a couple of young people with them who looked like sort of 20-year-old students. And I realised that I'd known that couple because I'd iced their wedding cake. And they brought their kids in as they were born, and their kids are now at university, and they were bringing them back to Fitzbillies to have a cake. And it wasn't even a special visit. It's just what they do. It's what Cambridge people do. And you think, I'm in that. I'm part of that now.
Yeah,
and it's lovely. But I remember when we took the lease over, the chap who was in charge of Pembroke then, I don't remember his name, and I'm probably not allowed to remember his name because he was the ex-head of MI5.
I know his name.
You know his name?
Yeah. You can remember. It's Richard Dearlove.
Yes, yes, yes. And we went to... We had a couple of meetings with him because he was going to be officially our landlord. And he took me out for a sort of a walk around the grass in the middle of the college. His sort of hands behind the back. And he was wearing a suit. And I think I don't know what I was wearing. And he says, I think of myself really fortunate here, a 600-year-old institution. I feel sometimes I'm merely a custodian of what's going on. Do you ever feel that? And it was much like getting tapped for MI5, I think it must be. He was passing a message to me secretly. Don't get ideas above your station, son. But yeah, look after it and we'll look after you. And it's just been great. It's really, really lovely. And to be part of that... I'm a totally non-Oxbridge boy to be invited. I've been invited to Top Table as well. Oh,
at
yes.
Pembroke?
I've been at Pembroke and I've been at King's. I've been to Trinity.
What do you make of the college food? Because I feel like some of the colleges have better reputations than others.
It's interesting. Most of them are very good.
It's got a lot better since our time, Laura.
People forget that we're a small to mid-size market town, but we've got 20 full-size brigade kitchens there. Mm. I mean, you don't even get that concentration in Mayfair. So there are hundreds and hundreds of brilliant young chefs working there. And when they let them do what they want to do, they are really, really good. Mm. The food supplies to them are second to none. I got taken around Trinity Kitchens a while back, and I have never seen such high-tech kitchens.
Have you been to the wine cellar? Because that's the one that's meant to be.
I could tell you if I had, but I'd have to kill you if I did. It is extraordinarily secretive what goes on down there. A really interesting feature to be written one day. But they'd find me floating face down in the can. Honestly, it is so secret, secret squirrel down there. I can tell you structurally that there are cellars down there that you could see as a cellar and recognise as a cellar. And there are cellars below those where you go through doors.
Wow.
And it's sort of mud floor. And there are some cellars below those.
Golly.
And it really is. And you do the maths and you realise these have got to join up somewhere. There's definitely something going on under there.
Mm,
but, oh, yeah. It's so exciting.
Tim, let's talk about your new book. It's called Steak, yes. The Whole Story. It's your eighth book. Tell us about the inspiration. And also, I spot on your arm that you've got Is beef a huge part of your life?
It's my only ink. Yes, gosh. So, my daughter's called Liberty, but that's not what the tattoo's about. It's really strange. Beef and Liberty was the motto of the beefsteak, the Honourable Order of Beefsteaks, which is an English society. I think they're 12 members. I think somebody has to die for a new one to come in. One of them is always the Lord Mayor of London. But they were a Whig dining society. And the principle was that your filthy Frenchman, he cuts up his beef and he makes gravies and stocks and garlic and ghastly things like that. where, and this is all sounding a bit Brexity, and I don't mean it to, whereas your true-born Englishman, he cooks the steak, the beefsteak, on a gridiron. And the symbol here on my arm is a small gridiron. Mm. And so they would get together above the Garrick Theatre, because I think Garrick was one of the founders of the club. And they would grill beefsteaks, they would drink porter and a dozen bottles each of claret, and they would sing patriotic songs, some of which are still kept in the records of the society, many of which are extraordinarily rude about the French. And I loved the idea of this. And I was making a BBC radio documentary, which fortunately never saw air, about meat, nationality and masculinity. I was really fascinated by the idea of the whole thing about, like, how we define ourselves as roast beefs, and the French regard us that way. At the time, we were doing the Grand Tour from England over to see the art of the Italians and the talk about the literature of the French and so on. They were sending their sons over here because they were not getting decent beef anywhere else. You came to England to eat the finest food, and most of that was beef. I mean, literally, we were the absolute heart of the world for this stuff. And it was a terrific story. And I love the idea that this was being done. And I had the tattoo on air.
Oh, wow, gosh.
And I thought I could record it as I was being tattooed. And there's a thing that happens where it cuts in sort of into the endorphins in your body, and it changes the way you operate. And you know, because you're doing it right now, that your brain, when you record, is running half a sentence ahead of what it is you're saying. That's fine until they stick the needle in your arm. And suddenly you're talking like a blah, blah, blah. Although
it looks like it's perfectly done, though.
Oh, no, it's beautifully done. The guy came out of retirement, didn't he? He was a great specialist. And he said, no, it's really interesting that happens. He said, men are rubbish at tattoos. He said, because men are mainly programmed that if they experience a little pain, they physically recoil from it. That's what we're good at. Mm. So we'll go into immediate fight or flight, or we tense up our muscles, we stand back, we make ourselves look big and get ready for a fight. Women, he says, for some reason, are entirely different about inflicted pain and know how to relax into it. And they're really nice to tattoo. So that was the only thing that stuck in my mind after the otherwise abortive recording.
And back up to the book. So steak, tell us about why you chose steak as the subject.
So I'm very lucky. I have an excellent publisher and we're very good friends and we talk about books all the time. And I think a while back, the idea of doing something about steak had come up because I like that kind of focus on something for 2 years work. You know, you start with the research, you do some travelling, you find out new angles, you chase them down, then you get a team together. I always work with the same crew. And we spend, you know, 10-day blocks, two or three of them, in one studio. We're designing, we're writing, we're photographing, we're cooking. We all eat together. And we make the book. We physically make the book at the end. And it is a remarkable experience. It's lovely. And steak seemed like the right thing. I suppose I was trying to find an in point. And actually, my publisher came over with her family. And her son, who's a lovely guy called Elliot, I think he was probably 13 at the time, quite an intense young man. And he'd become obsessed with steak tartare. And because he was coming over for dinner and he was interested in steak tartare, I said, well, what I'll do is I'll research steak tartare and you can do it tableside on the cart. You know, like the Eastern restaurants. I said, oh, that'll be fun. So we did it. And I spent 2 weeks just researching steak tartare. And I got to the end of it. He made the most amazing steak tartare that night. I wrote about the experience and it became chapter one. And it just made me think, no, that's all I need. That's reminded me why I do this, which is I do it because I can nerd out for 2 years in a really, really daft, male, shed-owning way. I can get right into it, and then I want to tell people about it.
Well, tell us, what do you think makes the perfect steak tartare after two weeks of research? What would you...
Oh, it literally making it there on the spot. That weird combination of ingredients where you've got some mustard and capers and onions and you mash it against the side of the bowl. It's all very simple. Mm. But, you know, it was more the fact that finding out more about it, I was finding out where it was first served and why. And that thing about the Tartars used to put pieces of horse meat under their saddles and ride for 2 days. So that's where they got stuck. But they didn't. It's rubbish. And it's great. And then, you know, even that, Christ, that's 400 words, the story and then why it's rubbish. And it sort of, it starts to form itself. And that became just really exciting. Then I started doing weird experiments about cooking and how to make it, how to understand it better. I ended up buying a special camera that the fire brigade used to look at burning buildings. to see where there might be people or where a room might be hot inside and things like that. And I started photographing steaks that I'd cut in half after I'd cooked them, so I could tell what the different temperatures were by the colour that the steak went in the camera. And it just got more and more and more bonkers. And then I started talking to butchers, and it just got madly out of hand and so exciting.
And how do you order your steak? What's your ideal steak?
Pretty much all of them. I mean, you can always make them interesting, no matter what they are, as long as they're reasonably sensibly sourced. I think the big thing that came out of the research for me was, weirdly, a bit of political economics. I hadn't really realised that at a certain point in American history, they'd had the cowboys driving the wild grass-fed animals in off the prairies. They were driving them to the railheads, where they would put them onto trains, and they would be taken across country to be fed as beef to other people. And the cattle ranchers, they were only cowboys for about 4 years. Did you know that? It's a strange thought. They only did the big drives across country for 5 years, because after that time, the railway lines went further out, and there was always a railway line near where you were. But the cattle barons had got huge, and they were a very large political force. So what they were doing was getting the cattle together and putting them on these railheads, and they were putting in fattening pens. So we're actually bringing in the cattle, when they would then feed them corn to make them fat, and they would kill them then, and they would put the meat on the train, and the train would take it and they sell it all over the place. But because they were very clever with what they were doing, they decided they were going to make meat fungible. So basically, a beef carcass, as long as the US Department of Agriculture had said this is an approved prime carcass, it had a set value across the entire country. And this was great because the farmers could sell them in advance, but it also meant you could trade in them. So you could create kind of financial instruments around them. So I could buy futures on the animals that you had on the field right now. And in fact, not only that, I didn't even ever have to see a cow, because I could then trade those futures with somebody who had pork belly futures going in over in Chicago, or they would trade with New York. But once the fungibility was there, you got this really weird thing, which is the Americans are obsessed with USDA prime steak. But they don't know the difference between an Aberdeen Angus and a Red Poll, because that doesn't matter. A prime steak is one that's been fattened to a certain degree, has a certain degree of fatness in it. And then there's a whole bunch of stuff where you start to realize that all that stuff you've been told about, well, the fat carries the flavour and it's all about the marbling. Tenderness, the obsession with tenderness in a steak. Mm. Of course, these are all things that when you're fattening the animals towards the end of their lives in these fattening pens, that's the best steak you can make, because you make that kind of fat steak. And you make that the prime steak, the premium one, the expensive one. You give it value. Mm. But actually, to me, in England, we are one of the last places now in the world that grass feeds its steak, a lot of it, all the way through. And our stuff is absolutely gorgeous. It was a weird, weird story, but I was trying to find, after I'd been instructed to find a way to start the book, I was instructed to find a way to end it. And I came up to London, and I came in on the Cambridge train into King's Cross, got in the cab queue, and I was behind this bunch of blokes, and there were 15 of them, and they were all late 60s, early 70s, and they were huge, huge, big, thick barrel necks, great big shoulders, clad in tweed from head to toe. And I thought they were some kind of superannuated rugby team. And I started chatting to them, and they were clearly pissed as you like. But I said, no, we're not a rugby team. No, we're Cumbrian beef farmers. And we're down in London. We come down once a year, and we go to Hawksmoor, and then we go to Borough Market, and we go and look at the state of the nation. I said, I've just finished writing a book about steak. And we stood on the cattle, on that line, me and those 15 guys, for an hour talking. And they're that shape because they go out into the fields and they move cows about physically. And cows are big. Unlike the American cattle, which you don't want to give an animal feed after it's achieved adolescence and puberty, after it's gone through it. It won't grow if you feed it more. It just gets older and grumpier. So most animals are killed at 12 months. Grass-fed cattle are often kept a lot older, a lot longer. They're allowed to mature. Their meat tastes better, much more delicious, much more complex. These guys are out there and they love their animals. And then they went to where, at the end of it, I also waved goodbye to them. And they got into three cabs, 5 minutes to a cab. And they were heading down towards Borough. And I remember the last cab going, and its rear suspension was bottomed out by the weight of Cumbrian farmers in the back. These guys are like, they're like Norse gods. Utter, utter heroes of the land, of the people, of the history, of just everything. And they're up there daily wrestling with cows whose names they know. They love them. We always cry when we kill them. Oh God, I mean, it's so beautiful, it's so glorious, and it's so part of us. And to then find, just almost as an attendant point, that we were the place where it was going to be great. So I was so proud of that finding. Oh God, it was so exciting. It was so much fun to do. But I think it was the other thing that from the very beginning when I was doing the tartar with Elliot, it also just told me something about me, which is I really love enthusiastically researching and then enthusiastically telling. And the actual bit of being a writer and sitting down and typing is kind of immaterial. It's just the medium you're using to get it across. What you're doing is you just like learning and telling. Those are the things I like doing.
And when you're not learning and telling, when you're at home cooking or with your family, what is comfort food for you, Tim?
Oh, gosh. Probably things I'm not allowed. Pasta, really, really good spaghetti. I love bread, obviously. I mean, I own a bakery, which kind of takes a lot of the sourdough thing away. But then I just sort of hop on my bike and nip over to the bakery and get something as it comes out of the oven. That's always a good thing. I'm obsessed with seafood. I love it. I've got a very good relationship with a fishmonger down in Brixham. And I get stuff that comes off the boat shipped up pretty much every week. I love it. I know a load of farmers locally. I've just found the most bizarre thing. It's absolutely lovely. You want animals that have lived a long life. But obviously, if an animal's been bred for meat, you don't want to be feeding it for too long. So they're killed quite young. The animals that we really like, the Italian animals that you would use for a Bistecca Fiorentina or the Spanish Chuleton or something along those lines, those are often animals that have lived 20 to 30 years as a tractor on a farm. They've got a purpose. They've got a reason. Dairy cattle, they reach sexual maturity and that's when they start producing milk. Once they can lactate, you can probably get 10 years out of them. So actually, if you have an ex-dairy cow, that can taste brilliant because that's had a long life and it's developed. This guy runs a tiny herd of Scottish cattle. They're quite low to the ground. They don't have to be put in sheds to overwinter. And this herd is taken about and it's released onto fields that they want to take back from agriculture and rewild them. And their little hooves stamp up and down on the field into the mud. They eat the wildflower seeds and the wildflowers that they throw into the fields. They just do that and then they poop it back out and stamp the poop in. And after a year, they take them off the field and they've turned the field back into a wild field. They move the cattle somewhere else to do it somewhere else. These animals are paying their way and occasionally they have to slaughter one. And so this is an animal that's lived an entirely full and productive life, utterly blameless. Most of them will see a vet once in their life when they're checked out just after they're born. They don't need vets at any point ever after that. They are the most natural and unbelievable animals. And the guy's lovely. And I just buy a cow from him sometimes. And it's just
The beef tastes delicious.
Absolutely sublime. Absolutely sublime. And you can do so many different things with it. And it's so exciting. And it's, yeah, I wish I had a sort of a favourite comfort food and things like that. That would be easy. I think I'm the absolute privilege of what I do is that everything I do is involved in some way with cooking or eating and people pay me to do it. And when I'm not doing those things, I'm having opinions about them and people are listening to those and that's even more ridiculous. But I'm getting it all ways and I can't believe my luck.
You cook a lot with your daughter, Liberty, who's now a grown up. How did having her change your relationship with food and cooking?
Oh, that's an interesting one, isn't it? So, yeah, there's a serious side to that and a genuinely lovely side to it. I think the serious side, there were a lot of eating disorders in my family when I was growing up. I was the only one who wasn't. And if you talk to any therapist, I'm not normal either because, I'm obsessed with food and I do it for a living. That's not normal. But it was a very, very key thing was to make sure she had good stuff, but none of the bad stuff, bad emotional stuff around food. So she had quite a free choice of what she wanted to eat, how and when. She was always involved in the manufacture and making of it. Most of our cooking at home is from base ingredients pretty much at all times. And she grew up in a quite old-fashioned small family business based around food and catering. So her attitude to food was quite healthy. She did, as I realise many, many young people do, you could have characterised her as a fussy eater at some points. Because given full choice, which children these days have, my generation didn't have full choice. Given full choice, they'll have the things that they like and they'll turn away the things they don't like or that are more challenging. But she's become an immensely excellent palate. She eats incredibly widely. But she's also very much like, we're a weird trio. We all have problems with authority and none of us can take instruction from anybody else. And all of our arguments and rows between ourselves about one of us trying to tell the other one what to do and the other one telling that person to right off. And that's the entire family dynamic is this kind of three-legged stool of yelling at each other about telling each other what to do. And so at no point in her life, I can guarantee it, at no point in her life has she taken a single instruction from me on how to cook. But she's a bloody brilliant cook. I was doing a dinner party and we had a sort of galley kitchen up one side of the room, same room we eat in. And I remember I was doing something, I was working at quite some speed on the hob, and I dropped my right hand down to the side and she put something in my hand. I lifted up, it was the right thing. She had put the right tool in my hand at the right time, and I can't get a commie chef to do that. But she was just on the button as a something like an 8-year-old. So it was always going to be good. But she has these quiet meals when she goes out entirely by herself and she doesn't have to explain to her friends how much she's going to spend on dinner. And nobody judges her on anything at all. And she keeps coming back with, "Dad, you have got to try this taco wagon." A taco wagon? For God's sake. No, you really have. She takes me to it. It's brilliant. I don't know. I took her out for a meal the other day at a French place in Borough, which was lovely. And it was one of those meals that I'd only ever had with adults before, where you start around lunchtime and it's fine. You get a bottle of wine and it goes on. And the staff clear up and go away. And the manager comes over and says, "No, you can stay. It's fine. You know, just leave before evening service gets too huge." And we're still there and we're still drinking and we're still sharing a dessert. And I realised I'd actually done what I must have done with 1,000 adults. I'd done it with my own daughter. I hadn't even noticed it. And it was lovely. You know, everything she wanted to say, I wanted to listen to. And she was interested in what I was saying. And we're talking about our lives and what we're doing. And it was just so great. And I thought, yeah, that's some kind of achievement, that is.
Sounds lovely.
In these days of food weirdness, that feels like a good thing.
And Tim, just to finish, we always ask our guests the same question, which is, what would be your ultimate meal if you had to come up with a menu for your... final, Liv and I haven't quite worked out this question, but desert island meal.
Desert island meal. So it would probably be, and this question comes up many times, there are lots and lots of glib answers. The actual truth is the real food enthusiasm is quite fresh. So very often it's what you've just been eating because it's fresh in your mind and you're really enthused about it. I've just come back from Paris. I had some really bizarrely traditional stuff when I was there and it really made me think, yeah, I need to reassess some of the things I've been thinking about with that stuff. And I'm quite enthusiastic about that. And that'll stick with me for a couple of weeks. But a couple of times I've had to sort of do the what would your perfect dinner party be or your perfect meal. I think it's a lot about the people. It'll be a lot about the conversation. And I think I'd probably want MFK Fisher to be there. And I'd want Len Dayton to be there. And I'd want probably Jim Harrison, who's one of my favourite food writers, and they're great. I'd want them to be there. And I want there to be loads and loads and loads of booze. I think it would be... I'm fairly sure I've located the exact place. There's a photographer called Slim Ahrens, who was in D-Day as a photographer. And he did all sorts of combat photography. And at the end, he got a job on American Vogue. And he said, "The only bodies I want to photograph on beaches from now on are going to be in bikinis." And he travelled all over Europe, going to all the places where the beautiful people were. And he took these amazingly stylized photographs of... It's just everything looks like the talented Mr. Ripley in his photographs. And there's a group of people having a meal halfway down a cliff face. I've located it. It's on the south edge of Capri. And you look at it and you think, I don't even know how the food got down there. There were staff abseiling to get the food down there. I want to be there. That's where it's going to be. It's going to be seafood, fresh from the sea, lots of it, and martinis. I've recently rediscovered the martini with an absolute zealotry that will just terrify you.
How do you have your martini?
Very dry, with an onion, so it's Gibson. But it's actually, I'm going to share this with you because this may be important. If you find yourself to be the kind of person that can start a bottle of wine in the evening and then consume it completely by yourself, and you find that you've done that sort of most days of the week, as many of us do, particularly in young parenthood, this becomes quite the thing. You realise I could cut down if I just had a martini at 6. So I now ritually build myself a perfect martini at 6 o'clock, drink it with all ceremony, and then I don't drink the bottle of wine afterwards. And so I've actually cut down my alcohol intake by about a half by turning entirely to hard liquor. This is the way.
That is the answer, Tim.
This is the answer.
Thank you so much for joining us on Table
Talk. Absolute pleasure.
And Tim's new book, Steak, is out at the end of May.